Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Live from the University of Minnesota, you are listening to Radio KS Culture Q, the Twin Cities Arts and Cultural Program, providing you the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Matt Curtis, and thank you so much for joining us. As we get closer to finals week, we can feel ourselves wearing down. Maybe you haven't had a decent meal in a while, or you've been stuck inside for weeks, cramming in the sub-basement of a library, and life may feel like a drone. We're here to help. Amy Friedman takes a bite out of the cuisine that the Twin Cities has to offer with only a student budget to spend. Katie Bullen visits Como Park Zoo to explore the beauty of Japanese gardens, and Nathan Curtis listens to drone music and discovers what one particular band has to offer. And it starts right now on Radio KS Culture Q.
Work here in any restaurant, we call it menu engineering. And what you try and do is you try and buy food, and then you want to turn that food over as fast as you can. So you want to plan your meals around the food.
Certainly many people from Europe and other countries came to the U.S. and they brought their love of gardening or their gardening skills with them.
Early stage, the band's live shows have become legendary, with the band performing in robes surrounded by thick fog and playing ridiculously low-tuned guitars as loud as humanly possible.
Instant ramen noodles have forever been the college staple. Throw in frozen pizzas, a few trips to McDonald's, and maybe some Gatorade, and you have a complete college diet. Spending money on high-quality food is not just a priority for most students, but a little secret amongst Minneapolis foodies that it doesn't have to be. Producer Amy Friedman brings you your guide to eating the best and freshest of the Twin Cities diet.
Living in the U of M dorms has driven a major wedge between freshman Maya Magruder and her love affair with food.
It's a lot of burgers and fries and pizza for options, and then you kind of have the standard salad bar that everyone gets sick of after a while.
Magruder walks me through the Sanford Dining Hall. We pass some of the more inspiring options, like the fresh salad bar and the make-your-own pasta bar, but then there are the kind of jaundicey hamburgers and droopy vegetables.
They're really overcooked, so I kind of go for when they have like mixtures of vegetables, a sauce, because that's better than like oversteamed peas that are really nasty all the time.
And what is the first thing staring seductively and greasily up at her when she walks through the door?
So I normally end up eating fries, like a lot of fries in the dining hall.
This is the eternal college story. A few decades ago, Mitch Omer was trapped in the exact same struggle.
What I figured out I could do was eat out at Perkins, and if I ordered coffee and French fries, that was their minimum order. So I spent a little over 2 years on a diet of pretty much coffee and French fries.
But Omer has come a long way.
I'm the executive chef and owner of Hell's Kitchen Restaurant and Angel Food Bakery.
If he could, he would go back in time to shake himself out of his French fry haze. But he can't. So instead, we met on his lunch break at a restaurant called Zalo. And he scanned the menu with his bright red glasses, sipped his Red Bull, and doled out advice. He says, you don't need to be rich to enjoy food. You just have to be smart.
I feel like a Zalo here. They do an impeccable job on their food, first off. Coming at happy hour lets you guys experience foods at regular prices, big enough orders that you can share.
This is his first tip for the cash-strapped college foodie. Seek out happy hours. They're not just about the drinks.
And you can eat 10 times better for as much or a little bit more.
But the real foodie doesn't just buy good food. They also need to know their way around a cookbook.
But I think a college student, get a get a friggin' hot plate and a slow cooker, and you can make anything. You can make 90% of the things in any one given cookbook, you know? Get a cheap cookbook.
One thing that can be really daunting when you're first learning to cook is preventing all of those tomatoes that you cleverly bought with a coupon from rotting in your fridge.
At work here in any restaurant, we call it menu engineering. And what you try and do, and you try and buy food, and then you want to turn that food over as fast as you can. So you want to plan your meals around the food. So you buy a rotisserie chicken, and one day you have, you know, chicken and noodles. And then the next day, toss it with a salad.
Oh, and by the way, right now is when you should be buying that rotisserie chicken. Which brings us to his next point, which is know the market.
Beef and pork, if you're eating meat, have skyrocketed, have gone through the roof. And we normally see a spike every winter for meat. Beef prices go up, sometimes they double. But right now, we don't have the herds to support the demand. So right now, beef prices and pork prices are wildly. So I would say, don't eat meat. Right? Don't eat pork or beef right now.
The same goes for fresh fruits and vegetables. Well, it can be tempting to get that $2 bag of frozen carrot, pea, and green bean mix that all somehow taste exactly the same. First, check to see what fresh produce is in season. They will probably be cheaper.
You know, right now, produce prices are starting to come down because more markets are opening up. California is starting to come out with strawberries again. They're not coming out of South America, which costs you more money. Same thing with broccoli, peanuts again.
But no matter how clever you are in the grocery store, Omer realizes that some aspects of the food world are just out of reach of most college students' budgets.
No, I'll tell you, I've got a cheese tray that we serve at the restaurant, and my food costs are terrible on it, because any decent cheese is expensive. I mean, it's just, cheese is one that is really kind of an entity unto itself, because if you're going to do good cheese, it's going to cost you some money.
No matter how much you plan and scrimp and strategize, eating well is still very much an elite privilege. The cliche is that college students live on ramen. Omer wants to raise this standard.
And it's exciting, I think, to be doing something other than making yourself ramen every night and then microwave popcorn. You know, it's a lot more fun, it's a lot more satisfying, and it's so much healthier.
For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
Some funky beats the fitness out there.
I found that, and I had a moment where I was like, do I put that in or don't I? And I couldn't not put that song in there.
When I was checking the studio computer downloads, the last one was like ramen music video MP3.
I always wonder if you guys find the songs that I download for my stories. But yeah, at the end, I don't know if you can catch it, but it's a little kid shouting, ramen party!
Live in the studio, we have Amy Friedman to talk about her story in a very serious manner.
Hello.
How are you doing, Amy?
So good.
It's great to see you.
Yeah.
Was it nostalgic for you to go back to a dining hall and be like, oh, I used to be this?
Oh, well, I have fairly bad memories of my dining hall. And actually, I was kind of surprised. I thought they had improved a little bit from when I was a freshman. But yeah, they're still not that great, though. Well, I think it's difficult, though, for them to kind of provide food for such a wide range of students. And so, I mean, they want to hear from students and they're doing what they can, but not ideal all the time. Not ideal.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
A lot of fries, as I was mentioning in the story.
A lot of, like, pretty bad vegetables. Not a lot done with them, but...
Well, you're exploring the foodie life in Minneapolis on a college budget. What did you find?
Yes. Well, so according to Mitch Omer, the man that I spoke to, it's mostly kind of, I mean, it's more intuitive than you'd think. I was thinking that when I went into this, that there'd be places where you could go, like different markets that you wouldn't think of to buy things. But really, like one of the things he said was like, Like, I'm 60 years old, and I still collect coupons and still hunt for all of those sales and buy the generic product sometimes. And so, and then also, like I had said, a lot of it just has to do with deciding that you're going to be educated about what the food market is like. So knowing what's in season, like, in you know, what's not in season, what's going to be more expensive or not. And then also taking a lot of time to plan out what you buy so that you can buy things kind of more in bulk and not waste them, which is something that I struggle with a lot. Mm. I always end up, there's a lot of rotting produce in my fridge. It's not great.
For me as well, yeah.
Yeah.
I just stick to greens.
Yeah.
You can rely on greens.
Yeah.
Why is it important to eat healthily as students, do you feel?
Well, for one thing, I mean, we're so busy right now at this time of our life, and we're always active and always doing things. And I think part of staying healthy right now has to do with taking time out of that life to eat well. And and you're also kind of, I think we're making a lot of habits for later too, and kind of. Like, I really want to get up on my cooking because I feel like I'm behind on my cooking skills. But, yeah, I know. It's just about staying healthy. A lot of things that you do now will affect your health later, too.
I completely agree.
But also, some people just, you know, like the foodie life. They like to eat well and appreciate food, but can't because it's too expensive. So,
mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Amy. Yeah. And we'll see you around.
Yeah, thanks.
What is the first image that comes to mind when you hear the word garden? Lush and colorful flowers, freshly cut grass, or strategically planned rocks amongst a tea house? Producer Katie Bolin pays a visit to the Japanese garden at St. Paul's Como Park Zoo and Conservatory to explore the history and modern-day relevance of Japanese gardens in America.
Certainly many people from Europe and other countries came to the U.S. and they brought their love of gardening or their gardening skills with them. My name is Tina Dombrowski. I am the horticulture manager of the Marjorie McNeely Conservatory at Como Park.
A large part of American garden styles has typically found its influence from Britain.
They like the more perennial, formal color bedding out types of gardens.
But many typical modern-day American gardens don't just draw inspiration from Europe.
Japanese gardens, in American ways, we have Japanese-style gardens here, so it's another style of garden that even homeowners practice.
So how exactly do Americans draw inspiration from Japanese gardens, possibly without even knowing it?
The way that the hedges are clipped or the trees are pruned, the spacing of the plants and the open spaces, what's there, what's not there, the simple design lines, and that's what people like about and admire about the simplicity, but yet it is not as simple as it looks.
And it all began after World War II.
The St. Paul Nagasaki sister city was really the first sister city relationship with a Japanese city, and it was following World War II in 1955. So at that time, there were many returning servicemen and many who did not return. The mayor and several people in the St. Paul community felt this was a good way to begin the healing after such a tragic war.
To facilitate this healing process between Nagasaki and St. Paul post-World War II, the two cities began exchanging small gifts like art and books.
It took a while, plans, and of course the culture, the barriers, language barriers. In that time there was no electronic communications. It was all by mail. Can you imagine, overseas? And the language barriers of sending it, you know, any kind of correspondence, it had to be translated. It took a while to get all the pieces in place.
However, 20 years after the sister city was established, Nagasaki decided to send a larger gift to St. Paul.
In 1975, one of the gifts that the city of Nagasaki gave to the city of St. Paul was the services of a Japanese landscape designer or garden designer.
That designer was Masami Matsuda, He spent almost 30 years over 7 trips to St. Paul to design and redesign his Japanese garden at the Como Conservatory.
My name's Christine Marin. I'm associate professor in the Department of Asian Languages and Literatures at the University of Minnesota. The idea of gifting a garden, I think, is very special. I have to admit that I've not heard of that before.
Tina Dombrowski.
Japanese gardens were a very common exchange to cities. And a lot of Japanese gardens and parks throughout the United States originated as gifts between cities and most likely affiliated with the sister cities' relationships.
The connection between politics and gardens in Japanese history goes back as early as the 6th century, as gardens were built for many rulers as a peaceful place of escape from times of conflict. Christine Marin.
My impression of the gardens was that they do have these very long histories. Sometimes gardens would be associated with Buddhist philosophy. Sometimes they had played a very important political role in early modern Japan, in terms of sort of tea houses where, you know, political conversations and so on would take place.
So what kinds of characteristics are present in the Japanese garden at Como that draw from these century-long practices?
Our Japanese garden borrows from the Japanese tradition of gardening, which is you use your local and adapted materials and plant material. That means so these plants, for the most part, are Minnesota hardy plants. They're not native. There are many plants that are adapted, though, to Minnesota. I have to say the exception, of course, is the bamboo. We can't grow bamboo in Minnesota, but we have a bamboo fence. We just buy the bamboo in.
My name is Christine Miller, and I am a professor and department head in landscape architecture.
In the spirit of using what's around you to build an eco-friendly garden, Christine Miller explains how this Japanese gardening technique can be used anywhere.
I think the key to sustainable gardening is plant choice and also knowing how much water you have and how you can limit the need for things like pesticides or fertilizer. So I think you can draw inspiration from certain types of Japanese gardens, remembering that when we say Japanese garden, we're referring to a whole bunch of different types, some of which have no plants at all, right? They're just rocks and moss and they're dry and they're raked. And so in sort of a desert climate, you could see how Japanese gardens that in Japan may have at one point been meant for contemplation, for not even occupying, just looking at rocks and rake gravel, could be a really beautiful thing to use in, you know, a desert.
Although nearly 40 years has passed since the Japanese garden was gifted to the city of St. Paul, the message and intention behind it all still carries a relevant meaning in modern society: sustainability, contemplation, and peace. For Culture Q, I'm Katie Bolin.
Hi, I'm Nyla. I'm the promotions manager at Radio K, and I wrote this week's weekly release spotlight, which was Black Diet's Find Your Tambourine.
They're a local band, I understand.
Yep, they're a local band. They are out on Pinata Records, which is a local label. All of the bands on Pinata kind of have like a similar like sound. I don't know. It's really cool. I'm a really big fan of that label.
How would you characterize the label sound?
Definitely, like, all of the bands, you know, there's some more, like, garage rocky bands and stuff, but they all, like, kind of have that, like, soul twang to them. Black Diet is kind of, like, garage indie soul.
And what sets them apart from many other local artists?
Well, in 2014, they won Vitamin's Are You Local Showcase, which was in the main room, and they got to go down to South by Southwest and play First Avenue's showcase they had there with all sorts of really cool local bands like Lizzo and Sunny Night and the Lakers, and that was really cool for them. So that's cool.
And they also got picked up by MTVU, I understand?
Yeah, they got picked up by MTVU. You can like go and vote, and they're playing their videos on the MTVU channel, which is really cool.
Is it their first album?
Yeah. This is their first full length. They had a 7-inch come out. It was a split 7-inch with Southside Desire, which is also on Pinata Records. But this is their first full length. It's called Find Your Tambourine. And they had their album release show at Jaime's for Record Store Day, which we actually sponsored. Got to hang out all day, and they were selling these little tambourines that said Black Diet on it in like all different colors, and there was like kids running around and like shaking these tambourines, and it was really cute.
We have a green one in the studio, right?
Yeah, there's a green one over there in between breaks, you know, whip it out, dance with the tambourine.
Exactly. What song in particular kind of stuck out to you in the album?
Unbroke and Thrown Stones, both really cool songs. Yeah, I'm broke. I don't know, I feel like I hear it everywhere. Like, every restaurant I'm in, it's always playing, or I'm, like, switching through dials in the radio, and it's always playing.
And you better hear it again. Here is Unbroke from Black Diet, straight from the first album of theirs, Find Your Tambourine, right here on Radio K's Culture Q. Unbroke by Black Diet from their first album, Find Your Tambourine, part of our weekly release spotlight. You can check out Nyla's full review and download a free track on RadioK.org. There exists music that seeks to find the weight in empty space. They find the beauty in the emptiness between notes and the fullness that these notes provide. Music reporter Nathan Goodis drones on about drone band Sun in this Culture Q Music Fundamental.
Take a moment and pay attention to the music that's been playing since before Matt made his introduction. But By the time you're finished listening to this Culture Cue piece, the track will still be playing. In fact, it won't even be one-third finished. Normally, in a music fundamental, you'll hear snippets from a variety of tracks spanning the chosen artist's career. But when listening to drone music such as this, it's important to capture the subtle and slowly progressing changes in these sprawling tracks. You're currently hearing Agartha, the first track off of drone metal band Sun's most recent album, and you'd need nearly 18 minutes to take in the whole piece. Sun has pioneered and defined the idea of drone metal with their minimalist compositions and extreme noise. You may not recognize the name Sun when spoken aloud, but you may recognize it written down. The band's memorable logo includes Sun spelt with two N's, followed by a zero with three parentheses. This leads people to often mispronounce the band's name as Sun-O, but actually takes influence from the logo of the Sun brand of guitar amplifiers. Formed in 1998 by guitarists Stephen O'Malley and Greg Anderson, Sun was not the first band to play in the drone metal genre. The duo even picked their name Sun in response to the name of the band that inspired them most, Drone Doom Pioneers Earth. However, rather than purely mimicking the sound they were inspired by, Sun took the drone template a step further, removing almost all percussive elements and almost all sense of tempo or timing in order to create true soundscapes as opposed to traditional songs. From an early stage, the band's live shows have become legendary, with the band performing in robes surrounded by thick fog and playing ridiculously low-tuned guitars as loud as humanly possible. The band's first release, the Grimrobe Demos, and the 00 Void full LP were released in 1999 and 2000 respectively, and contained fairly simple compositions featuring highly distorted guitars. However, the band was never one to rest on their laurels or refuse to progress forward. The band's second album, Flight of the Behemoth, saw the duo collaborating with noise artist Merzbo to create even weirder sounds and compositions. Their White Sessions birthed the staggered release of the band's third and fourth albums, White 1 released in 2003 and White 2 released in 2004. These albums saw the band stepping out even further, starting to explore Druidic and Norwegian lore through spoken word sections accompanying their experimental drones. The band experimented even further in their fifth and sixth albums, 2005's Black One and 2009's Monoliths and Dimensions, which contain the track you've been listening to, saw the band branching out into collaborative efforts, featuring guest musicians on nearly every track of both albums. They progressed far beyond their original guitar-based sound, incorporating classical instrumentation, choral music, and more. In addition, the band has fostered their collaborative tendencies throughout the years, releasing collaborative albums such as Alter with drone metal band Boris, and their most recent release, the joint effort Terrestrials with experimental group Ulver. Founding member Greg Anderson has also fostered the scene through his label, Southern Lord Records. Created alongside Sun in 1998, the label has not only released nearly all of Sun's music, but also signed a wide range of doom and ambient bands, such as Boris and Pelican, up to modern metal bands such as Wolves in the Throne Room. Ambient drone music may never work its way onto the top 40 charts, but Sun has been working tirelessly to make sure the genre has kept a solid footing in the underground. From releasing their own critically acclaimed albums to helping others in the genre succeed through collaborations and their own Southern Lord record label, Sun remains a vital and influential force in the drone music community. For Culture Cue, I'm Nathan Gerdes.
Don't You've been listening to Culture Show on Radio K, hearing every Sunday at 6 p.m. bringing you all the stories from the Twin Cities that you won't hear anywhere else. Tonight you heard the voices of Nathan Gurdes, Amy Freeman, Katie Bolin, and Matt Curtis. Our producers are Amy Freeman, Katie Bolin, and Parker Lemke. Our music reporter is Nathan Gurdes. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and I'm Matt Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, PRX, and iTunes. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. See you next Sunday at 6 p.m., and thank you for listening.